The producer was Tracy Neal.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, Hannah Gordon reads episode 2 of Martin Stannard's biography of Muriel Spark. Aged 19 and eager to leave her hometown of Edinburgh in search of adventure and life experience, Muriel marries a man 13 years her senior. They travel to southern Rhodesia, where she discovers that he has a serious mental illness. After behaving in a threatening and violent way towards her, she leaves him, taking her son with her. War is declared and she flees Africa on a troop ship, returning to London in order to pursue her dream of a literary career and to a living for herself and her son, whom she leaves behind in a convent in Africa until the war is over.
In 1936, aged 18 and eager for romance, Muriel greeted her uncertain future cheerfully. While the Spanish Civil War was raging, Europe hurtling towards another global conflict, and against the backdrop of the Depression, life at 160 Brunsfield Place had never been merrier. Muriel lost weight, wore lipstick, put her hair up, and went out dancing. The Overseas Club on Princes Street was considered a select establishment. Muriel and her brother Philip attended its dances regularly. One night, she met a man there who changed her life. Small and nervous, Sidney Oswald Spark was a lapsed Jew. Very little was known about his family. Muriel's father was suspicious, her mother prepared to be generous. Sidney seemed a kindly fellow, intelligent and besotted with Muriel. And Ozzy had done well for himself. He was a mathematics teacher and considered himself an intellectual. So did Muriel. It seemed to be a meeting of minds. She was 19, he 32. She enjoyed being the object of an older man's infatuation. He seemed restless and interesting, planning to emigrate to teach in Africa. Muriel was attracted to this exotic prospect. Above all, she wanted to escape from Edinburgh and its claustrophobic social microcosm. And so, after a year of chaste courting, they became engaged, and he left for southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Shortly after, on the 13th of August, 1937, she was aboard the Windsor Castle with her third-class ticket, diamond ring, and trunk, waving goodbye to her family as the ship slid from Southampton docks. Muriel Spark may have been raised in Edinburgh, but she grew up in Africa. There, she said, for the first time, life and death came very close together. She loved Africa's wildness, but as to marriage, she soon realised that she had made a terrible mistake. These formative experiences are briefly sketched in her autobiography, Curriculum Vitae, and elaborated in a series of brilliant short stories. The Seraph and the Zambezi, The Portobello Road, The Curtain Blown by the Breeze, Bang Bang, You're Dead, The Pawnbroker's Wife, and The Go-Away Bird, written in the 1950s and 1960s. A long time passed before she turned to prose fiction, had to pass, perhaps, before she could assimilate the revelations of her 6 years in the tropics and South Africa. When she did begin to write about them in The Seraph and the Zambezi in 1951, she drew directly on those banked-up feelings. Each story focuses on a young, acute white female and confronts her with forces threatening conformity or obliteration. For a while, Muriel tried to play the wife, but her husband was seriously disturbed. Ozzy had a 3-year teaching contract. Muriel had entered into the arrangement on that basis, that their emigrant life would be temporary. In 1937, southern Rhodesia was barely 50 years old. The vast territory of the colony was populated by 55,000 whites and about 1.5 million blacks. It was a gun culture, and Ozzy, in his feeble and distracted fashion, was infected by its machismo. He bought a baby Browning revolver, which he liked to fire off in corridors and courtyards. One of the many things Ozzy had failed to tell Muriel about himself was that he had been seeing a psychiatrist before their marriage, and that his desire to work in Africa had been prompted less by a sense of adventure than by the fact that he could not hold down a job in a British school. When she asked him why he had withheld this information, he replied that had he been honest, she wouldn't have married him. Within weeks of their arrival in Fort Victoria, he was in trouble again with the education authorities, and she was pregnant. He proposed that she have an abortion. She refused. The baby was born on the 9th of July, 1938, in Bulawayo. Although she was devoted to her son Robin, postnatal depression set in immediately and lasted for months. Sexual relations had ceased with the birth, probably long before, and never resumed. When Ozzy tried bullying, she withdrew further into chilly distance. He beat her up. That was it. Any remnants of her original affection disintegrated with those blows. In their quadrangle hotels in which they stayed, she and Robin had one room, her husband another next door. They were effectively separated. After 2 years of this, seriously frightened of Ozzy, Muriel hid his revolver, feeling that he was quite capable of shooting her. One of the more amazing coincidences in her life was the discovery that an old friend from Gillespie's, Nita McEwen, was staying in the same hotel. Nita, also red-haired, was known at school as Muriel's double. One night Muriel heard a disturbance and an explosion. The next morning, she discovered that Nita's husband had shot and killed her, and himself. It seemed like an omen. War had broken out. All civilian transport home was stopped. She had to be cautious. On one occasion they visited the Victoria Falls in the hope that it might relieve Ozzy's depression. It didn't, but it proved a formative moment for her. When Muriel's African life began to shape itself into those short stories, she felt, she said, a compulsion to describe the Zambezi River and the approach to the falls through the mysterious rainforest as a mystical experience. The Smoke That Thunders is the name given to the falls by the local tribes. Amid this great roar, one looks up, one looks down, and from side to side. No more sky, no more forest. Everywhere is a mighty cascade of water. I knew my married life was over. Strangely, the experience gave me courage to endure the difficult years to come. The falls became to me a symbol of spiritual strength. It made for the reasonable contemplation of our humanity and a sense of the proportions in which we should think. The escape route was art. Throughout her time in Rhodesia, she wrote poetry and read voraciously. Part of Ozzy's irritation must surely have derived from the realization that he had married a woman who was infinitely more intelligent and tougher than he. She was frightened only by Ozzy, not by Africa. Indeed, those first 2 years taught her something which was to become characteristic of her mature literary voice, the ability to think in two directions simultaneously. In Bang Bang You're Dead, this double life is rendered by a brilliantly simple device. Muriel's resemblance to Nita McEwen was the seed of this story. How easily Muriel might have been the victim. In the story, Sybil is back in England, watching the home movies of her African existence with a group of friends. Their banal commentary is spliced with flashbacks into the reality of Sybil's experience, which ends in murder. She should have been the victim, but her jealous lover mistakenly shot her lookalike neighbour. Intercut are Sybil's own psychological crises, which focus particularly on her sexuality. The character muses, For some years, she had been thinking she was not much inclined towards sex. Can it be, she thought, that I have a suppressed tendency towards women? She surveyed with a stony inward eye all the women she had known. No, really, she thought, neither men nor women. It is a not caring for sexual relations. It is not merely a lack of pleasure in sex. It is dislike of the excitement. And it is not merely dislike, it is worse. It is boredom. Was this autobiographical? If it was, it might at least answer the question about whether she was or was not gay. Muriel, it seems, had thoroughly interrogated herself about this and had dismissed the notion of a suppressed tendency. It was her art, not her sexuality, which estranged her. God and Scotland might somehow have omitted sentimentality and the agonies of sexual desire when they created Muriel Camberg. But she had received something much more valuable in return. Immense willpower, distance, wit and vision, without which she could not have become the great comic artist of the macabre that she did. Muriel knew she had to free herself from Ozzy, get home, and earn her living as a writer. But the declaration of war on their second wedding anniversary trapped her in Africa. No civilian passage to Europe would be available in the foreseeable future. But she was not to be deflected. Ozzy joined the army, and from that moment they were on the road to divorce. By 1939, she had begun her literary career in earnest, submitting articles and poems to local magazines, winning a first-class award for poetry at the Rhodesian Eisteddfod Society, reading her material on the radio. But pleasing as these successes were, they were no kind of living, and she took a series of secretarial jobs. The separation crushed Ozzy. When all hope of reconciliation had evaporated, he became fanatically possessive. He stalked her. Muriel became convinced that her husband was a psychopath. In rages, he had threatened to kill her. The divorce was made final in March 1943. But the crucial, appalling problem facing Muriel was how both to escape from her husband and to keep her son. In order to support Robin, she had to work, but there was little chance of making a career in letters anywhere but London. The divorce courts were not interested in Ozzy's mental condition, which meant that, astonishingly, they would award custody to him. There was, in any case, a complete embargo on transporting children to the UK. It was a quandary to which there appeared to be only one desperate solution. If she could settle Robin safely, she would escape without him. Her only hope was to return to England, explain her case from there, and pray that after the war, the British authorities would see sense and return Robin to her. The first step was to place him as a boarder in a convent school in Gwelo, after which, in February 1944, she obtained a berth with 30 other women on a troop ship zigzagging its way between U-boats via the Azores to Liverpool. At night, the women were stacked 4 deep in bunk beds and instructed to remain fully dressed in case of a German attack. But danger was the last thing on Muriel's mind. In her tight berth, she read Eliot's The Dry Salvages, contentedly anticipating life as an artist. And by March, a year after her divorce, she was home and free.
Martin Stannard's Muriel Spark, the biography, was read by Hannah Gordon and produced by Kirstine Cameron. Tomorrow, a unique literary voice is discovered. Beating 7,000 entries, Muriel Spark wins the Observer's 1951 competition.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, Jim Lee here. It's 3 o'clock and we turn our attention to drama now on 4 Extra as Katerina prepares to deal Dmitri a fatal blow after Ivan's dramatic appearance at his brother's trial. It's the final part of The Brothers Karamazov. At 4 o'clock, Mel Gedroych hears from this week's birthday boy, X-Man himself Patrick Stewart, and more drama this evening when Alexander McCall-Smith's Precious Ramotswe sets up the number one ladies' detective agency. Hear it at 9:15. So now to the final part of this week's classic story of faith, doubt and reason set amid a changing Russia and centred on three brothers and the murder of their father. The eldest of the boys, Dmitri, is in the dock for the crime, but Ivan's shock confession has caused uproar in the court. And now Katerina claims she has a full confession which proves Dmitri's guilt. It's the fifth and final part of The Brothers Karamazov.
How could you be anything but angry? But I swear to you, dear Alyosha, I did my best to stop Ivan from coming to the trial.
He's not thinking about that. Not at the moment, are you?
You should go home.
I will not go home.
There was no one in the house to help me, no one. He got up, he insisted. I could see he was still ill, feverish.
It's not your fault.
Oh, I told him you'd asked me to stay with him, that you'd left instructions that he was not to come here. He didn't even bother to argue. He just kept asking me for a comb, of all things.
What happened? What did Ivan do?
He gave evidence.
And?
He accused himself of the murder.
How extraordinary! Why did he do that?
I don't think he even knew where he was. The judge should never have let him speak.
Of course he had to speak. Everyone must perform. It's a circus. The audience is avid with curiosity. They wanted to hear him. I'm sorry, I missed it myself.
You're right. They want to satisfy their curiosity, not to find the truth. It's horrible how little it interests them. The truth. It's not about justice, any of this. Are we really so cruel, so indifferent to the suffering of others?
What did Dmitri do? Did he try and stop him? Or was he thrilled? Did he see a glimmer of hope for himself?
No. He stared at Ivan. He said something. I can't remember. I think he was shocked at the state Ivan was in. I mean, no one should have paid any attention to what he said, but the atmosphere in there was almost as feverish as Ivan was. When he accused himself of the murder, there was a sensation in court, people shouting, and then...
And then?
She must have thought he was in danger.
She?
Katya.
Oh, of course, Katya.
She must have thought that the judge might seriously suspect Ivan. She felt she had to intervene.
So Katya stood up. I can imagine the moment. She stood to her full height. Her face pale. Did those beautiful eyes flash?
I'm afraid I can't joke about this.
But I'm not joking.
Lisa.
What a moment. Torn between her faithless fiancé Dmitri and the man she truly loves. His brother, Ivan. What is a poor girl to do? What did she do?
Don't quarrel. We three at least must remain friends. The world is full of sorrows.
How true.
She had a letter in her hand. It was from Dmitri. It proved, she said, once and for all, that he was the murderer. She did it to save Ivan. That's what she said. She's going to read the letter to the court this afternoon.
Oh, is she? Thank God we're in time for something good. Oh, Alyosha, I'm sorry.
It's all working out very nicely. For Katya, at least. I take it she has broken it off with Dmitri now. We won't have to listen to her talking about trudging off to Siberia with him anymore. What a relief.
I must find Miss Grushenka. Excuse me.
Of course. Off you go. I dare say she needs comforting.
Yes, she does.